Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is University of Tulsa Law Professor Robert Spoo, who has just received a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship to assist in his scholarship. Formerly a professor of English at the University of Tulsa and former editor of the James Joyce Quarterly, Spoo's encounters with literary copyright holders spurred an interest in law. He eventually went back to school and became a lawyer, and that interest has continued through the publication of his previous book, Without Copyrights, Piracy Publishing in the Public Domain, and his current project, which examines how modernist authors encountered the law. His project, Modernism and the Law, will look at authors like Oscar Wilde, James Joyce, and Ezra Pound, and how they confronted a variety of legal issues, from privacy rights to obscenity laws, copyright and moral rights, defamation and blackmail. These are legal issues that still draw litigation today, especially among celebrities, intellectual property owners, and how all of their rights relate to the digital realm. Robert Spoo is the Chapman Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Spoo, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the Guggenheim Fellowship.
Thank you, Rich. Great to be back.
Most people know that a Guggenheim is a prestigious award that fine artists and visual artists and literary figures and people in the arts and letters, if you will. But what's really involved in getting a Guggenheim Fellowship?
Well, first of all, I want to say how, you know, really pleased and delighted I am for this to have happened, and the support that I've had here at the University of Tulsa, the College of Law, the Chapman Chair that I have currently, all that has been part of this. It's not possible to do this without support, I think, and supporting your scholarship. But what happens with the Guggenheim is it's essentially an application process. This year, I understand about 3,000 or so applications were received. Of those 3,000 in the United States and Canada, about 175 were chosen. And that's in areas ranging from very broad as to discipline, ranging from the sciences, math, chemistry, to many of these are in the fine arts, in music, in dance, in visual arts. And then there's a group in the humanities and social sciences. Mine fell, in this case, within the humanities and the field of English literature. And really what it means, I think it's for many of us, we think about this as something that you strive for. It's not something that can come often soon in a career because, as I understand it, what they look at, they often describe it as a mid-career award. And they look into your past. They see what you've done in the previous years. They look at previous books. They ask for submissions of books that you've written. And then they focus also then on an immediate proposal that you have for the Guggenheim period, either 6 months or a year, depending on what the applicant is interested in. And so they look both backwards and into the present and the immediate future, and they base it on that. And it's something that you cross your fingers about, and then you you wait and hope.
Now, your project that you applied for was an upcoming book called Modernism and the Law. Before we talk about that, I know this has been an area of emphasis for you for a long time. It goes back to your time as an English professor when you were part of the James Joyce Quarterly. And of course, law is all bound up in the Joyce estate, a very litigious estate. Is that what spurred your interest in sort of this intersection between writers and law?
It was, in many ways. Well, here's what happened in a capsule version. When I was an English professor here on the other side of campus at the University of Tulsa, as you say, I edited the James Joyce Quarterly, and I arrived here as a scholar of modern literature, as a scholar of James Joyce, and the one thing that they never taught me in graduate school, they taught me a lot of things, never taught me this one thing, and that is my field was owned by other people. That is to say, as a modern literature scholar, I discovered my field was filled with copyrights owned by others besides myself. And that's not something, for example, that the Shakespeare scholar or the scholar of, Jonathan Swift or something like that has to contend with, because all of those texts are in the public domain and have been for decades or centuries. So I encountered a problem of, somebody owned part of what I wanted to do, and in the case of the James Joyce estate, we encountered, we Joyce scholars, a lot of conflicts because that estate was very protective of its copyrights, and it doesn't like scholarship very much, and used the copyrights to create interference and difficulties for scholars. So that problem made me think, well, I've got to learn something about the law. So I began to study on my own. I began to take courses over at the College of Law here at TU part-time while I was teaching full-time in English. And my interest just carried me further and further. I went off to law school, transferred to Yale Law School, got my JD, and went on, clerked, practiced, and all of a sudden I was in law firms practicing copyright law and now working with both copyright owners and people who wanted to use other people's copyrights, and fully in that world. Then I had the great opportunity in 2008 to come back here to the University of Tulsa, but this time on the other side of campus at the College of Law, where I've been ever since and happily teaching and writing.
It must be very frustrating when, you know, you do all the study as part of research, as part of becoming a doctor of letters, and all of a sudden your research is basically bound up by pleasing somebody who holds a copyright who may only have the vaguest connection to the person who actually may have wrote the material you're interested in.
It's true. We think of the academic life as a life of freedom of expression. In fact, it's one of the great arguments for tenure. You know, we seek tenure. That is, they cannot fire you for what you say. And then you encounter copyright owners who either say, you can't say this at all because if you do, I will bring some sort of legal trouble to you. Or they say, if you want to say this, I want to make sure that I read and vet what you've said to make sure that it accords with what my family wants to have said about so-and-so, granddad or grandmother.
Or it could even be lawyers for the estate. It might not even have anything to do with the family at that point.
Absolutely. You could get a contact from a lawyer saying, you have not cleared rights for this. So all of a sudden, your academic freedom begins to look like a different sort of thing.
Now, your project is going to look at the beginnings of this era where all of a sudden artists and writers began to have these sorts of rights. Prior to the modernist period, really, writers had very few rights in their works. Is that correct?
That's true in a lot of ways. I think that in this period, which begins in the late 1800s for me and then moves into the early part of the 20th century, people define modernism differently, and in my case, I think of it sort of 1880s through 1940s as the period that I'm quite interested
in. Sort of literary modernism.
Literary modernism. I won't be dealing much with the visual arts or with music, although those subjects are tremendously interesting, and you could write on those as well. But for me, this period, for writers especially, is a period where laws, both laws that were possibly impediments for them and laws also that they might invoke against others, began to, I think, be very intensified. The individual author began to be affected more and more by copyright laws, by obscenity laws, and other sorts of legal regimes.
Now, you use a couple of artists as sort of guideposts for your project, and of course it's still underway, so we should mention that things may change before it is actually published, but you're using Oscar Wilde as one, Oscar Wilde, who had both personal issues with laws and sort of draconian laws, as well as issues with copyright, the unavailability of copyright of his works abroad, mm-hmm. and James Joyce. And Ezra Pound. What are special about these three authors?
Well, Oscar Wilde, I think, has always, for many people, been a fascinating figure. He's flamboyant. He's hilarious. His plays, The Importance of Being Earnest, most people have seen it, and they know about The Picture of Dorian Gray, his fascinating novel about the young man who never seems to age. So Wilde himself is fascinating. But Wilde, as we know, got very caught up in the law, partly because of his own courting of legal danger, I think. Most famously, of course, he was convicted in a criminal court in England of a crime called gross indecency. And that had to do with certain sorts of intimate relations with other men. And he went to prison for 2 years at hard labor. One always thinks of this flower of the aesthetic period, of the decadent period, going into prison and having to walk the treadmill or do other very strenuous chores all day or much of the day. And he came out a wreck. He didn't live long after that. But it's not just that. That was the high or the low moment of his of life as far as the law went. But he was also very immersed in law in other ways. For example, he was an early proponent of privacy laws that would allow well-known persons to have some privacy from the media, from inquiring newspapers and writers.
Now, we think of Wilde as somebody like a celebrity today that actually exploited the media of the time to gain, to be by being flamboyant and by attracting that attention. At the same time, he was seeking protection from it.
This is the way with all celebrities, even today. They want selective fame. Of course they want fame, and Oscar Wilde wanted, courted, and enjoyed fame in England at the time. He was the toast of London at a time when he had, say, three hits going on the stage in London at the same time. At the same time, he wanted to be left alone in certain ways, and this is the reality with celebrities today. Notice how they draw the line at certain sorts of paparazzi activity. Some, you know, they'll even throw a punch sometimes at a paparazzi.
And at the same time, at official events, they're courting those same paparazzis to take pictures of them.
Absolutely. Oscar Wilde was very offended, for example, when he found out that the poet, John Keats was, as we all know, a very famous romantic poet. He died very young, and he had a correspondence with a young woman, a romantic exchange of letters. And these letters came up on the auction block in London in, I think, the 1880s. And Oscar Wilde was outraged that these intimate letters would be made into an article of sale. And he wrote a famous sonnet denouncing this marketplace exposure of the secrets, the romantic life of a great poet.
Of course, that today, there's markets for anything a writer such as Keats or any writer within the last 100 years has done or older. You know, I mean, those are marketable commodities, and they're also the subject of intense scholarship, too.
Absolutely. And what's fascinating to me about Wilde's obsession with Keats's private letters is that this is a period in which privacy rights, what we think of as the right of privacy, the right to be let alone, that we could go to court to try to defend, these are still being formed at that time. So the whole notion of celebrity is becoming itself an institution and a commodity in the late 1800s, but at the same time, and probably for the same reason, a sense of privacy, a sense of those areas of life where we want to be left alone are coming into discussion. And soon, within a few decades, we would have privacy laws or privacy rights.
This sort of takes, we're going to move ahead in your study, but one of the other things you're looking at is also defamation and blackmail, which sort of goes along with this sort of idea that you have this public persona and you are this public figure. And Oscar Wilde himself was the subject of blackmail attempts. And you're going to look at this particular issue. Is blackmail sort of a late 19th century invention?
Well, blackmail had existed before that. As long as there were secrets that somebody had been indiscreet enough to, say, put into a letter that was then somehow let into somebody else's hands, well, there could be threats of extortion. But it becomes very intense in the latter part of the 19th century, in England especially. And in the case of Oscar Wilde, there was this crime that I mentioned he was convicted of, gross indecency, was based on an amendment of British legislation that was called the Blackmailer's Law. And the reason it was called the Blackmailer's Law was that it, by broadly condemning certain sorts of sexual behavior, it created a whole class of blackmailers who could, once they obtained information about a private individual's life, they could then use that to try to extort money.
Now, did the English class system play into this too, and the sort of the, well, the 19th and the 18th century sort of notion of honor and sort of privacy, this all played into it, right? And all of a sudden, all the social rules are changing, yet there's this sort of clinging on to those older rules.
Absolutely. There's a strong class element to a lot of this because, of course, while this kind of private sexual behavior ran across all classes, it was especially something that a person of high class and also of wealth or high profession wanted to conceal. For example, when the day Oscar Wilde was convicted of his crime, it's said that a large number of upper-class men boarded the train that night to get to the coast to go over to France. So there was a strong reaction to this, and it is very class-based.
Was that a reaction to the fact that he was basically imprisoned for being a homosexual?
Absolutely.
And if it could happen to Oscar Wilde, it could happen to me.
It could happen to me. This, you know, so something that had been private behavior that was either not known or somehow tolerated, all of a sudden it appeared this is not being tolerated, and now I'm in danger.
Yeah. You also look at obscenity rights in laws during the 19 early part of the 20th century, and you see things like James Joyce, D.H. Lawrence, their works are being declared obscene. What are you looking at in that particular area?
Well, when you look at Oscar Wilde's crime of gross indecency, so-called, you see that here's an individual whose private personal behavior has gotten him into trouble with the law. In this other case, we have writers, men and women, who wrote works and published works. The works were the target for laws now. These works were deemed obscene. Obscenity is also something that becomes very intense as a legal problem in the latter 1800s and into the first 3 to 4 or 5 decades of the 20th century. So works that we now think of as classics of modern writing, Lady Chatterley's Lover, Ulysses, The Rainbow by D.H. Lawrence, many works like that, when they first appeared were very, very strongly contested by the law. They were often suppressed. Their publishers were sometimes indicted. The works themselves were sometimes banned or burned or somehow challenged and destroyed. So this is a period in which the works themselves become the target of prosecutors.
My guest today is Robert Spoo, the Chapman Professor of Law, who recently received a Guggenheim Fellowship for his work on an ongoing work of scholarship titled Modernism and the Law, which looks at the relationship between modernist writers like Oscar Wilde, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, and the law in its many form and guises, everything from obscenity laws to privacy rights to copyright. And of course, your previous book looked at how publishers exploited the loopholes in copyright, the fact that you're only copyrighted in one country or countries with agreements with one another, and how publishers exploited that. Sometimes authors would exploit that in their own way. Are you looking more at that?
I am. I've always found copyright to be fascinating. We just talked about obscenity law, and obscenity law was one way to prevent a book from reaching the public, and it was the state or the government that was doing the preventing. When you look at copyright law, as I mentioned earlier with the James Joyce estate and other estates, sometimes it's then a private estate or a private individual copyright owner that is controlling a book, either allowing it or preventing it from getting to the public. Well, copyright laws historically have been imperfect things, especially here in the United States, where throughout the entire 19th, or almost the entire 19th century, and in some ways well into the 20th century, our copyright laws were very isolationist and they were very protectionist. They did not protect foreign authors, British authors, French authors, and so on, the way they protected American authors. So that really for almost the entire 19th century, American publishers were able to freely publish any foreign author's work. And they exploited this expansively. Many thousands and thousands of works by foreign authors were freely published in the United States without any copyright protection. That continues into the 20th century for various reasons. So authors like James Joyce, like D.H. Lawrence, like Virginia Woolf had their foreign markets, they had copyrights in their home markets or the European countries in which they lived, but they went in fear of American copyright law because they weren't clearly or necessarily protected here. And that created a lot of problems for them. It even created certain litigations, which Joyce was involved in.
Mm. Now, I was reading your proposal to the fellowship, and I may have read this wrong, but we think of tariffs, you know, in a time of not free trade in the early 20th century. Were there actually high book tariffs to import a book from somewhere else?
There were. At various points, it was as high as 25% tariff on imported books. It went to 15% early in the early part of the 20th century, but it was considerably high. So when you think, on the one hand, that copyright, the U.S. copyright laws were already protecting American industry, American printers and publishers, by essentially making it impossible for foreign authors to have a copyright in the United States, so they couldn't compete in that respect. They only became a resource. Then on the other hand, you have any attempt to import a British book being subject to a very high tariff. This created great, we talk about walls nowadays, this is a major wall that went up around an invisible wall of protectionism that made it very difficult for foreign publishers and authors to compete here in the United States.
Mm. Well, we'll look forward to the book, Modernism and the Law. When's it due out? Next year, you think?
Well, it's got to be written. I've begun the research and some of the writing. It's going to be a short book, about 60,000 words. I have a publisher, and we're hoping that I'll have the manuscript in sometime next spring, a year or so from now. And we'll look maybe to later in 2017.
If we talk about copyright and trademarks and all the issues of protection of image and word today, it seems like, if anything, from the time you're describing, the pendulum has swung completely to the opposite side. Everything's copyright. Everything's trademarked. And, of course, we're coming up on a sort of a relook at copyright within the next couple of years. 1998 was the last extension. We think of that as the Disney law, because it protected the images of the cartoons of Disney, but it helped an awful lot of major businesses. Are we expecting another extension of copyright, say, in 2 years? Or what do you think is going to happen?
Well, a lot of us have been copyright watchers, and we are keeping our eye on that, whether once again there will be a great lobbying effort to get another extension of copyrights. As you mentioned, Rich, in 1998, there was something often called the Mickey Mouse or the Disney law, but it was actually called by Congress the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. It was in honor of then Congressman Bono, who had been a great supporter of this bill. And as people may recall, he died in a skiing accident. And so the bill was named in his honor. It was passed in 1998. It extended all copyrights in the United States by 20 years.
And it also created a host of other problems, because all of a sudden things that had been in the public domain, there was a way for them to move back out of the public domain. And
well, there was a related law, which we have learned about. There was another Supreme Court case over it not too long ago that restored copyrights in certain works that had fallen into the public domain. You're right. There was what we've seen the last 20, 30 years is a sort of great expansion of copyright laws, trademark laws, publicity rights, and other types of laws that have created a landscape of, well, some of us believe, hyper-protection. So your question about whether the lobbying, we're now within 2 to 3 years of coming up on that 20-year anniversary of the Sonny Bono Act, whether we're going to have more, whether there is more lobbying going on. We haven't heard it, but I think that there are fewer good arguments for extension of copyrights now than there were 20 years ago.
There have been a number of authors and arguments talking about the loss of the public domain. Do you think that is a fear if they try to extend that?
If they extend it again, we are looking at a couple of different problems. One is, yes, the public domain seems to be then receding from us. It's supposed to arrive, and there are publishers, there are scholars, there are consumers that look forward to the public domain, that actually bank on the public domain arriving, because then these works are available and they can be used without high payments of permissions fees and so forth. And as laws expand for intellectual property. It is clear that the public domain, to that extent, recedes from us. Well, we don't want to see it, I think, recede again. That's one problem. The other problem is, and this was a challenge in the Supreme Court about 15 years ago, and whether this sort of incremental extension of the copyright law might violate the Constitution, because the U.S. Constitution says that copyrights must be for limited times. Limited times means it can't be eternal, it can't be infinite. Of course, the argument can always be made, well, adding another 20 years is not infinite.
It's only
another 20 years. But in practice, if there is a continual copyright creep of this sort, maybe that is an infinite copyright, just in installments.
Yeah. Now, trademarks is another area that has exploded. Trademarks, likeness rights. I mean, there's every type of right available. Is that just the way it's going to be from now on?
Well, it is. I mean, trademarks can be rather easily obtained as long as somebody is making use of a word or a phrase or a logo or even a color somehow in commerce in relation to a product or a service continuously. Well, trademarks can exist. And what we will see more and more as some of the very important cultural properties begin to enter the public domain copyright-wise, such as the Disney films, such as Mickey Mouse, things like that, that are extremely famous and have been the subject of huge investments. As those things begin to enter the public domain as to their copyrights, I think that we will see, many of us think we'll see an assertion of trademark rights. So, for example, when Mickey Mouse cartoons begin to enter the public domain and people want to make use of the Mickey Mouse cartoons without paying fees and having permissions granted, we will probably see assertions of trademark rights in Mickey, because, of course, trademark rights for the Disney properties exist. We have Mickey shirt, T-shirts, Mickey mugs, all kinds of things. And that will be an interesting development. We'll see how that goes, whether you can make use of Steamboat Willie and the early cartoons and not be attacked for somehow violating a trademark right. That will be an interesting next phase.
That really will be. You know, the idea that the T-shirt with the modern version of Mickey relates to Steamboat Willie or some of the early cartoons. Yeah.
Right.
Really interesting, and we wish you great success with that, and congratulations again on the Guggenheim Fellowship. Robert Spoo, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Robert Spoo is the Chapman Professor of Law at the University of Tulsa. He recently received a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship to assist in his scholarship on modernism and the law. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.